This is an ABC podcast.
Just over 6% of the world's oceans are protected marine habitats, according to the UN, meaning no fishing. The other 94%, well, you know. Each year, we take around 80 million tonnes of marine life from the seas and turn it into everything from fish fingers to cat food. At that rate, the future won't just be one of depleted fish stocks, but empty oceans.
Overfishing is a very relevant question, especially with climate change and also the number of people relying on fish for their food security, but also for their income or their livelihood. The biggest markets of the world, so the EU, Japan and the US, these are the three biggest markets in terms of importing. The EU, for example, imports 60% of its seafood from elsewhere. So you cannot see it as just a local problem. It is really a global problem. So it will only become more relevant in the coming years as there's more and more investments in the global fishing fleet. The global trade in fishing products is only increasing, so it will remain a very essential question for us to solve and to tackle.
Vanya Volperhorst, the campaigns director for the non-government organisation Oceania. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. Today, as we look at the global overfishing crisis, we'll focus on two major players, China and the EU, the European Union. And later, we'll hear some suggestions for better fishing management and regulation. But let's start first with the EU.
They fish everywhere in the world. They fish in the Pacific, they fish in the Antarctic, they fish in near the Arctic, in the waters of Greenland. There are different numbers given for the total number of EU vessels. The official numbers are 255. We estimate that there is actually 23,000 EU vessels that have a license to fish outside the EU, but these also include small vessels in the Mediterranean. So there is also not even a clear estimate of the number of vessels, but let's say that there's many of them indeed. And this is a big part of the EU catches. So 20% of what the EU catches is coming from these vessels that fish outside of the EU.
Many governments subsidize their fishing industries. Is that a big part of the problem? Do those subsidies actually have an impact on the size of the fishing fleets heading out to sea?
Definitely. So most governments of the world give fuel subsidies to their fishing fleet. So this means that you never pay taxes on your fuel. Similarly, the types of vessels that fish outside of EU waters can be very, very big. They can be hundreds of meters. And these also rely on subsidies for fuel, but also other types of subsidies. For example, in Europe, unfortunately, you can get a new engine for climate mitigation. But as NGOs, we actually think that these type of subsidies can be harmful to the environment. They're actually not having a positive effect.
And which countries in Europe top the list in terms of overfishing concerns?
So there's not sort of one country that is overfishing the most. There are some countries that are not following the EU rules. So we, for example, have had issues with Italian fishing vessels that keep fishing in protected areas, but also that fish in the waters of Sierra Leone and don't comply with the rules there. Same with vessels from Latvia, for example, quite a small Baltic country. They have a big fleet fishing all over the globe, and they also have not been the strongest in sort of complying with EU rules. But there's not one on terms of overfishing. It's more in compliance of the rules that we try to sort of make sure that Europe is doing better because they should do better.
How widespread is illegal and unregulated fishing globally? And is it on the rise?
It's estimated, but these estimates are very, very old. Unfortunately, we rely on estimates that have been done 10 years ago. It's 1 out of 5 fish is caught illegally. As you can imagine, a European fishing vessel that doesn't have an inspector on board, it's really hard to make sure that they comply with the rules if they want to not follow them. It is really hard to make sure that fishing vessels oblige with international and national rules in any case, because they operate so far away. The supply chain has become very complex. So there's many steps in the chain where you can launder your legally caught fish. The supply chain is global, so you can catch fish in the Pacific, you can bring it to port in a European country, and it's just really hard to make sure that everything is happening in a legal way.
And I assume that most of the illegal fishing by European countries would happen in international waters. Is that the case?
No, unfortunately, it also happens in European waters. Same problems happen here. It's just really difficult to make sure that every fishing vessel adheres to the rules. So there's illegal fishing ongoing in European waters as well, where they catch certain species they're not allowed to catch. They use the wrong nets that they are not allowed to use. They fish in protected areas. So we see this also happening in Europe, but also outside of Europe. And of course, it is even more harmful, you could say, if it's happening in countries that really rely on fish for their food security and for their livelihoods, that illegal fishing of foreign vessels is happening there, and that includes European fishing vessels.
Vanya Volperhorst from Oceania. Scientists have calculated around 33% of fish species across the world are now overexploited. The number being fished to their maximum level is around 60%.
The fishing season has opened on the eastern coast of China. The fleet in Zhoushan is on the move. 500 trawlers will head deeper into the oceans this year and stay out for longer.
China has been the focus of much recent concern. Each year, the country consumes more than a third of the global catch. And the activities of their distant water fishing fleet have come under particular scrutiny. The scale of operations and their intent on fishing anywhere and everywhere has begun to cause geopolitical ructions.
When a vast Chinese armada appeared outside the Galapagos Marine Reserve in South America, Ecuador's government had reason to be suspicious.
Well, the Ecuadorian government reported 260 vessels stationed at the edge of the country's exclusive economic zone. And that's quite big. But in spite of that, it's only a fraction of how big the whole Chinese distant water fishing fleet is, which we estimated in more than 16,000 vessels.
Dr. Miran Gutierrez, a research associate with the Overseas Development Institute, a global think tank.
As oceans are depleted, fishing fleets are traveling further and further away from their coastal waters. And, you know, this is fairly recent for China, but the problem is that, you know, the sheer volume of this distant water fishing fleet is what is troubling and a problem.
These Chinese distant water fishing fleets are able to operate, as I understand it, 24 hours a day. How is that possible? How do they do that?
Well, they're able to operate 24 hours a day for many days, even months, and, you know, I was going to say years, but, I mean, they're able to operate 24 hours a day for different reasons. One is thanks to transshipments. Transshipments are operations in which ships resupply cargo, fuel, and also fish at sea, you know, in high seas, without having to go back to port, which, you know, it could be costly, you waste time, you have to pay for port fees, etc. Another factor is that in some of these fleets, sailors live in semi-slavery conditions. You know, they work extremely hard, and they are not allowed to, you know, go back to port and see the families, etc. So basically, these two factors allow these vessels to operate 24 hours.
The Chinese government did implement new regulations last year, including, I understand, harsher penalties for illegal fishing and fishing moratoriums. Is that a step forward, or should it be seen as window dressing?
It is a step forward, but it's just a small step. The scale of what it needs to be done is huge. China faces a great challenge in meeting stated goal to reduce its distant water fishing fleet to only 3,000 vessels by last year, which, you know, it hasn't happened. That was what China had promised, and it is not, as far as we know, a reality. Going back from 16,000 vessels down to 3,000 vessels, it's a very, very, very big challenge.
We shouldn't make the mistake of thinking that everything that China does is driven by some strategic plan, etc. And particularly in this case, in terms of distant waters fishing, in my view, clearly the principal driver is to gather as much animal protein as or fish protein as possible for the Chinese market. That's driven the expansion of their distant waters fishing fleet almost over the last 10 years. But as with much of what the Chinese state does, whenever there is an economically driven plan, it also includes a significant strategic element too. So there'll be a comprehensive plan to take advantage of the presence of a very large Chinese fishing fleet all over the world.
The Australian National University's Dr. David Brewster, a senior research fellow with their National Security College.
It's well understood that among many of these fishing fleets, there'll be intelligence gathering vessels, and they can be relatively easily identified by the number of antenna that they will have coming out of them, which is very different from the usual fishing vessel. But also, very commonly, the Chinese use fishing vessels as, I suppose, cover for the introduction of their maritime militia. This is a militia force, a maritime militia force, which reports to the Chinese Navy, and they're used to undertake what's called grey zone operations, which are designed to win a particular issue without fighting. So we see the use of these maritime militias disguised as fishing vessels in disputes, for example, in the South China Sea with Vietnam, where they're used to build a physical cordon around something. So if the Vietnamese government is conducting oil search operations, for example, these vessels will be used to surround it and block off access, for example, to the Vietnamese. And so when vessels disguised as fishing vessels are used in this way, it makes it very, very difficult for other governments to respond because they're not really sure how much force they should be using. I mean, it would be a very bad look, for example, for a big Navy ship to be firing upon what appears to be an unarmed fishing vessel. So the use of this maritime militia, or the little blue men, as some people call them, is very useful for the Chinese government because it allows them to get results while maintaining a significant element of deniability.
We're already seeing tensions because of the sheer scale of Chinese international fishing. Mm. Is it likely that as the need for protein increases, we see more of these fleets or more of these vessels going out, that causing more tension? Is it likely that we will see greater support provided to these fishing vessels from the Chinese Navy, for instance, overt support from, say, the Chinese Navy?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. Not necessarily the Chinese Navy, but certainly the Chinese state. And we've seen a number of incidents all over the world where Chinese official vessels have supported Chinese fishing vessels. So, for example, there's been two incidents where Indonesian Coast Guard ships have arrested an illegal Chinese fishing vessel operating in Indonesian waters. And then the Chinese Coast Guard or another state agency ship has intervened and forced the Indonesian Coast Guard to let the Chinese ship free by threatening the Indonesian Coast Guard ship with force or through jamming their communications, etc. And we've seen other incidences as far off as off the coast of Argentina where Chinese fishing vessels tried to ram and sink an Argentine Coast Guard ship that was trying to arrest it. And so we're seeing in these instances quite assertive behaviour from the Chinese fishing fleet and the Chinese state in protecting their fishing fleet. And we should certainly expect that to continue in the future. So that, just for an example, in the Indian Ocean, there'll be various areas where the Chinese fishing fleet will operate, perhaps either legally or perhaps illegally, and there will be growing frictions with local fishermen who, you know, see their livelihoods being destroyed. And there's a significant chance that we will see perhaps confrontations between local authorities and Chinese authorities who want to protect fishing vessels, and that could easily escalate. And so we've already seen the introduction of private security contractors, mercenaries, if you like, to protect some fishing fleets in the Indian Ocean. And you could imagine a number of scenarios where these confrontations could turn deadly and spur on greater friction and conflict between some countries and China.
And is there any way to prevent that, or has the die already been cast to an extent?
Look, it's not all one way. Certainly, there are indications that Chinese authorities have been clamping down in some selected instances against the most egregious incidents of illegal fishing by some of the Chinese fleet. There is an element of concern about China's international reputation, and so that will moderate this dynamic somewhat. But ultimately, if it comes to it that China needs fish protein and the Chinese government believes that their fishing fleet, their distant waters fishing fleet, is operating with legally or with some justification, then they will act to protect what they see as their national interests. And, you know, as I said, there are a number of ways that this could escalate. Another actor which I haven't mentioned is NGOs, and some countries are increasingly using NGOs to enforce their exclusive economic zones where they don't have their own capabilities.
NGOs being non-government organisations.
That's correct. So there's been several instances where NGOs have stepped in and said to a developing country, look, we can come and help you enforce your EEZs. We know you don't have the shipping, the vessels or capability to do it, we can help you. You know, that adds yet another element into this mix that you could see an NGO trying to prevent Chinese illegal fishers, say, for example, and then Chinese Coast Guard vessels coming in to protect the Chinese fishers. Now, this has all been escalated a little bit because earlier this year, there was a new law passed by the Chinese government about the power of their Coast Guard, and that gave legal authority to the Chinese Coast Guard to use all necessary means to stop or prevent threats from foreign vessels, etc. So now that means that the Chinese Coast Guard has been officially given authority to protect Chinese vessels. So we can see that there's certainly a lot of risk of these confrontations and escalation in various parts of the world.
You're with Future Tense on RN, ABC Radio National, exploring the world around us, looking for the pathways ahead, and signposting the future.
And today on Future Tense, we're focused on overfishing. Having heard the problem, let's now look at what can be done to try and better protect fish stocks in the future. In 2017, the European Union undertook regulation reforms designed to increase both accountability and sustainability. A welcome first step, says Vanya Volperhorst.
So what we advocate for is transparency. If you know who can fish where legally, what and when, it is easier to see who is the illegal actor and to take action against that illegal actor. So we really call for all nations to make public where their fishing vessels can fish legally so that we can weed out the illegal actors. So what the EU does is that it makes agreements with non-EU countries to allow the EU fleet to fish there. So actually this is European money, so EU subsidies going to a country like Mauritania or Morocco to allow a certain number of EU vessels to fish there. Before 2017, we had no idea which vessels were fishing where and how many subsidies they got. Now, since the reform, the European Union makes public on a weekly basis where the EU fleet fishes outside EU waters. So it's not a real-time tracking mechanism, but at least it gives you information on which fishing vessels or the actual vessel go where. And this is a big step in the right direction. Also, it allows you to see this vessel is not on the authorized list, so it must be fishing illegally, and it allows us to give an alert to the national country and to the European Union. So we actually encourage other flag states, so who have a big fleet fishing elsewhere, and coastal states, so countries that, for example, allow foreign vessels to fish in their waters, they should also make this type of information public. So we do see this as a very positive step. Now it's about taking action against those vessels that are not on the authorized vessel list, because this does still happen, that the data on there is either incorrect or there's just illegal fishing ongoing. So now we want those member states to actually take action when we see this occurring. Vessel monitoring devices. So this is a satellite device that is placed in the fishing vessel that sends every 2 hours currently a ping to the authorities where the vessel is. This is required for all vessels above 15 meters in the EU, doesn't matter where you fish. They also need to have AIS, which is the automatic information system, which is used as an anti-collision device, but this is also publicly available, which is, for example, used by a website called Global Fishing Watch. So you can see actually European fishing vessels fishing all over the world using this automatic information systems. So this at least is required, but we do see that vessels turn off these type of vessel tracking systems. The official one from the authorities, normally you should not be able to turn that off. You cannot tamper with it. But the one that's served as an anti-collision device, we do see that being switched off when they, for example, go to areas where they're not supposed to go. So transparency in this sense is really key. And also what we are doing, at least in Oceana, is that we work with sectors such as the insurance sector, but also other sectors we are looking at now to make sure that they do not provide services to illegal fishing vessels. So there is an international list of illegal fishing vessels. They should not insure these type of vessels, which has happened actually in the past. So we're trying to tackle the idea of illegal fishing from multiple angles, but the most overarching element is transparency and a need for more public information.
But it isn't just about transparency and accountability. It's also about going back to the very basics and getting better at determining how many fish there are and how many can be caught.
I am Jason Link. I am the Senior Scientist for Ecosystem Management with NOAA Fisheries.
NOAA being the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States.
So there's certainly lots of good fisheries management all around the world. I don't want to imply that. What I am saying is so often we forget to tie it all together and realize that these fish in the ocean are interacting and they bump into each other, eat each other, compete with each other, whatever. And what I'm getting at is even in places where we have really excellent laws and regulations to manage the fisheries, we forget that any given piece of the ocean is only so productive. So, for example, my dad has a farm, and when we are trying to figure out how much head of cattle to put in any given pasture, we need to understand how productive it is, how much grass can grow, how much hay can be there, etc. And when he does that, he can get a sense of how much beef he can produce. Now, of course, when we ignore the fact that that pasture only has so much that can produce, we forget that there are limits to production in any given place. The other downsides are sometimes we miss signals. If you see a bunch of stuff happening all at once, you miss that by focusing on one stock at a time. And those limits then lead us to overfishing. And we've had a long history, 70, 80, 100 years of looking at that at a population level for one species at a time. But we haven't looked at it entirely as a composite system.
So the answer, says Jason Link, could be to adopt an ecosystem approach, not a species-specific one. And it's time, he says, for a new common standard for tracking the status of overfishing in global fisheries.
So an international standard for fishing, there are several. The FAO and several nations have put forth examples, the Code of Conduct for Responsible Fisheries. In our country, we have several national standards that we adhere to, and those guidelines help us when we manage our fisheries. Several places do that. But again, what we're calling for in this new approach is, okay, those might be good, but let's look at the entire system and maybe come up with these measures of what we call, instead of single species or stock overfishing limits, maybe there are ecosystem overfishing limits. And by calculating those using, you know, satellite imagery and satellite information on vessels or, you know, reported landings, relatively simple things, those standards could then be utilized. Anybody can have access to that data. There's databases all around the world that have that information. And we can use that standard to say, hey, in any given piece of the ocean, have we pulled out too much? That's by definition what overfishing is, when you're harvesting at a rate greater than what the system can produce. And by doing that at this ecosystem level, we're hoping to head off some other problems that happen when you overfish one critter and then you move on to the next critter and so on and so forth.
So these ecosystems would cover both national waters and international waters, would they?
Yeah, it would depend on the jurisdiction and the authorities being dealt with. There's certainly international regional fishery management organizations to handle some of the high seas waters, international waters, as you say. And then certainly each country has their economic exclusive zone, or EEZ. The EEZs are often managed by the nations or the states, and those approaches would be equally applicable there.
Would this kind of system, focusing on the ecosystem level, would it be faster in determining when fish stocks are low or threatened?
I think so, Anthony. When we have done this, it's, again, a relatively simple calculation. Some of them are pretty straightforward. You don't have to do a whole involved analytical approach. It's simply, like I said, grab some satellite data, grab the catch data from all the reporting elements, and what does that look like? What does that tell you? If you're around a threshold, maybe we need to pay attention. If you're 5, 10, 20 times above that threshold, all right, we need to take a really close look at this. And if we're below the threshold, then okay, keep on proceeding.
You've nominated three indices that should define this global standard. Could I get you to take us through those?
So one is called the Ryther Index, named after the famous fishery biologist Ryther. Another one is called the Fogarty Index, and another one is called the Friedland Index. The Ryther Index is really the amount of fisheries catch per unit area. The Fogarty Index is the amount of fisheries catch relative to estimates of primary production. For your listeners' sake, the small plants in the ocean and how fast they can produce and grow things to go up through the food chain. And the Friedland Index is basically the same kind of information catch, but it's relative to a measure of phytoplankton, or small little plankton, small plants in the ocean, and the pigment that's based on them, called chlorophyll A. So you're looking at catch relative to chlorophyll A. And, there's always, as most scientists would say, there's nuances and caveats to that, but that's the gist of those three indices that we're proposing. They give you slightly different looks, and there's slightly different underlying theories behind all three of them. We didn't want to have just one diagnostic. We wanted to have multiple in case we might overlook a small caveat of one of the different indices and what they were trying to show. So if you see ecosystem overfishing on one of the three, okay, we need to probably look at it, keep an eye on it. If you see it in all three of them, then you probably suspect something is going on. And if you see it in all three of them and it's way above the threshold, okay, we probably need to look at this a lot more quickly and perhaps even more urgently. So the different ecosystem indicators can allow you to look at these systems and almost triage, if you will, how the system is responding to these overfishing pressures.
Jason Link from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in the United States. We also heard today from Vanya Volperhorst, David Brewster and Miren Gutierrez. Karin Savanovitz is my colleague and co-producer. You've been listening to Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.